Today is Friday, May 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. What does China's new security law mean for Hong Kong?
Unfortunately, one country, two systems is irreparably broken at this point.
Plus, the families of Rwandan genocide victims want others held accountable for assisting Felician Kabuga's 26 years on the run.
This community in France wants these people also to be persecuted and be judged.
And a look at the technology of the SpaceX Dragon. We'll have those stories and more next. Hong Kong told the United States to keep out of the debate over national security legislation being imposed by China and warned that withdrawing the financial hub's special status under U.S. law could backfire on the American economy. U.S. President Donald Trump plans to hold a press conference today about China amid soaring tensions between the two powers, including over the status of Hong Kong and the novel coronavirus pandemic. Asked about a report in the New York Times that the president was considering throwing out thousands of graduate students, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said on Thursday that Chinese students shouldn't be in our schools spying. The New York Times said that the Trump administration was considering annulling visas for thousands of graduate students linked to China's military. The move would be certain to draw criticism from universities, which rely increasingly on tuition from foreign students, of which China and India are the largest sources and have already been hit hard by the COVID-19 shutdown. Hong Kong, a former British colony, has been racked by civil unrest over fears Beijing is curbing the high degree of autonomy it has enjoyed under the one country, two systems formula adopted when it returned to Chinese rule in 1997. Earlier, I spoke to RAND Corporation senior defense analyst Derek Grossman about the developments and the implications for the region.
Unfortunately, one country, two systems is irreparably broken at this point because one country, two systems, which is the system put in place when Hong Kong was transferred from Great Britain to China back in 1997, essentially says that Hong Kong is part of China, one China, but can maintain separate legal and economic systems. And so what we saw in the last few hours with China unilaterally imposing the national security law from its National People's Congress, it creates the conditions in which China can now freely interfere in Hong Kong's domestic affairs. And that could, and it could entail lots of different things. For example, one is that China can now set up agencies like, for example, intelligence agencies, police agencies within Hong Kong to manage the Hong Kong protesters in the future or rioters from their perspective. Another example is that Hong Kong's court system now can no longer have foreign judges serving on rotation through their system, which had been customary prior to this national security law being imposed. And so China will now be able to more actively play a role in the selection of those judges. So this really does have kind of fundamental implications for Hong Kong's legal system. And economically, a lot of the problems that Hong Kong may face in the future are going to come from countries that it has been carrying out economic interactions with, for example, the United States.
I want to step back for just a moment and ask you this. Over the past few years, Beijing has inked out different deals with neighboring countries in Southeast Asia, like Cambodia, like Laos. They've also inked out deals in Africa. What can these nations learn from China's actions towards Hong Kong that they should be looking out for in light of their deals with Beijing?
Yeah, I mean, you bring up a good point. If China is going to go back on its treaty obligations, such as in the case of Hong Kong, then, what does that mean for China maintaining its obligations with these other countries? Could these countries essentially be giving over their land to China and those parts of their countries become kind of a semi-colonized or colonized status? That is unclear to this point. That's why all countries need to be careful in making these types of deals with China. And by the way, it's all usually under the auspices of Belt and Road Initiative. And that's why folks in the West have really, you know, had a lot of concerns about that program and what it means for these countries maintaining their territorial sovereignty in the future.
Derek Grossman is a senior defense analyst with the RAND Corporation. There's a whole lot more to our conversation than I was able to fit into today's program, and you can listen to it on our website. Just go to voanews.com, click on the live radio button, and then select our show from the all programs list. You'll be able to see the conversations listed as a VOA IE Extra. The mayor of Minneapolis said early Friday that the city is in a lot of pain and anger, but the looting and burning to protest the death of an African-American man while in police custody is unacceptable. Protesters in the city are enraged by the death of George Floyd Monday night, while a white officer knelt on his neck while he was in custody. 500 National Guard soldiers have been activated at the request of Minnesota's governor and will be deployed to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the surrounding communities in the north central state. Several stores in Minneapolis and neighboring St. Paul were set on fire Thursday night. St. Paul police said officers were hit by rocks and bottles. There were also reports of looting in St. Paul. AP correspondent Tim McGuire has more.
The top county and federal prosecutors in Minneapolis say they are determined to find justice for George Floyd, a black man who died while in the custody of four Minneapolis police officers. The U.S. Attorney for Minnesota, Erica McDonald, says, however, the violence has to end.
The obstruction and the destruction of property and harmed individuals has got to stop.
Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman says he is determined to prevent the same outcome as the Freddie Gray case in Baltimore.
It was a rush to justice, and all of those people were found not guilty. I will not rush to justice. I'm going to do this right.
A half dozen police officers were charged in Gray's death. There were no convictions. I'm Tim McGuire.
Protesters have marched in cities across the country, including New York, Denver, and Los Angeles, to support calls that the police officers who arrested Floyd be charged with murder. There are more than 5.8 million cases of COVID-19 around the world, with more than 360,000 deaths. The Americas are the new epicenter of the outbreak. The U.S. has more than 1.7 million coronavirus infections, followed by Brazil with more than 438,000 cases. United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres has warned that the pandemic would cause unimaginable devastation and suffering around the world, including famine and massive unemployment, unless governments start taking preventative measures now. A French study has found that 1 in 10 diabetics who contracted the coronavirus died within a week of being admitted to hospitals. Most of the 1,317 patients in the study published in Diabetologia, the journal of the European Association of Diabetes, had type 2 diabetes. This weekend, oncology experts are holding an online conference. They plan to discuss a new study that says COVID-19 is especially dangerous to former and current cancer patients. The study in the journal Lancet looked at more than 900 patients with both diseases in Britain, Canada, Spain, and the United States. Researchers found that cancer patients were more likely to die within a month than COVID-19 patients who never had cancer. One of the authors of the study, Dr. Jeremy Warner of Vanderbilt University, said this is the reason many hospitals are urging cancer patients to delay or modify care by staying away from facilities where there are many coronavirus patients. In addition to the physical burdens of COVID-19, the disease also poses an emotional and spiritual challenge for patients, the health workers who treat them, and for the loved ones who care and all too often later grieve for them. In the next part of our interview series with healthcare and hospital workers, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Matthew Arlick via Zoom. He's an ordained Presbyterian minister and staff chaplain at Einstein Medical Center in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Reverend Arlick began their conversation by explaining that physical contact and nuanced facial communication are the go-to tools of the chaplaincy, and the pandemic challenges his ability to provide hands-on solace and comfort in traditional ways.
I'm so used to the experience of providing support to people who are in grief, in trauma, as such a tactile and physical one. You know, I rely so much on nonverbal communication, on people being able to read my face, but also for me to be able to read theirs. And so it's harder to have an experience of your impact on people, because if I go into a patient's room who's COVID positive, then I'm wearing a gown and gloves. And if I'm going to be close to them, literally at the bedside, then I also would be wearing a face shield. And so even though I'm wearing a mask, my eyes become that much more important in terms of what they convey. I can still gesture with my hands.
I understand that a hospital chaplain's work isn't only with patients, but also with the staff as well.
Absolutely. That happens both on a very informal basis where we just are talking to staff and just checking in with them and seeing how they're doing, to much more programmatic efforts of having call-in times for prayer, for mindfulness and moments to show appreciation for staff. But it's always an ongoing challenge to provide care to staff because staff are very busy and don't necessarily feel comfortable opening up about how they're feeling.
Are you able to level with each other about these difficulties?
Oh, yeah. That's a big part of connecting with them is empathizing and being able to be vulnerable and being able to share a little bit about my own experience.
Help me understand why religion and spirituality belong in a hospital of all places.
I believe that we are all spiritual beings in that we are all in the process of making meaning. And it's been very challenging in this time of COVID for people to make meaning of this experience because it's unprecedented and it's a particularly unsettling time. For some people, it's their beliefs get validated. For others, it really shakes those beliefs to their core. What my experience has been, what I hear people talking about is interconnectedness, both in ways that are beautiful and kind of emotionally supportive, but also in the ways in which our interconnectedness is also what right now is dangerous. In our hospital, we've had couples that have died, people who have lived together for their whole adult lives, and because of that closeness that they have infected each other and have died because of that closeness.
You mentioned the beauty of interconnection as well. What about for you?
Speaking from my personal experience, I've connected with all kinds of staff who I never had before. Clerks, people who work in registration, janitorial staff. I think there's a sense in which we really are all in this together. And I find that people are responding so much more honestly when we're all struggling so much.
This is exactly what you signed up for as a hospital chaplain, isn't it?
Yeah, this is what I feel like I was called to do. And I'm so grateful that I've been put in this place at this time.
Now, you're an ordained Presbyterian minister. How does your own personal faith and theology figure into your work during the COVID era?
A big part of my Christian faith has to do with a very particular kind of hope that I think is sort of unique to Christianity, in that it's sort of irrational, almost foolish hope in God's ability to break through in a world that can feel utterly dark. And it really feels very distinct from optimism. Because personally, I find it pretty difficult to be optimistic in the world that we live in. But I'm always hopeful. And I think that that really comes from that sense that God can do the impossible. And that's kind of manifested in Jesus's life and in Jesus's death and resurrection.
Are you saying there's some sort of golden message hidden in this catastrophe?
I mean, I'm careful not to say that this is happening for a good reason. But I do think that there is always a seed of transformation, even in the worst trauma, the worst oppression, and the worst kind of evil, whether it's human-made or whether it's a disease.
Matthew Arlick is an ordained Presbyterian minister and hospital chaplain at the Einstein Medical Center in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. And coming up later...
We had hope. It was bad in the morning. There was lightning. But our launch wasn't in scheduled until 4:33, I think, p.m. Eastern time. And so they were like, oh, we can clear up. And it did get better. And then it got worse.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
About 66 million years ago, the Cretaceous Tertiary extinction event is said to have destroyed about 75% of the Earth's plant and animal species. The most popular suspected cause of this mass extinction is the Chicxulub impact event, in which a 10-kilometer-wide asteroid smashed into what is now Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. Researchers led by Imperial College London have created new 3D simulations of the asteroid impact event. From these new simulations, the researchers found evidence that suggests the asteroid impacted Earth from the deadliest possible angle of 60 degrees, which boosted the amount of climate-changing gases that were forced from Earth and into the upper atmosphere. These gases are said to have blocked sunlight from reaching Earth, starting a species-killing chain reaction known as a nuclear winter. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The arrest of Rwandan genocide suspect Felicien Kabuga is stirring up emotion and determination for a conviction from Rwandan citizens living in France. International Edition's Lori London spoke with Richard Gisagara, attorney for the Rwandan Community Association in France. The group is calling on French prosecutors to identify and launch criminal investigations into those who aided the accused genocide financier during his 26 years on the run.
What we want now is that Kabuga be judged. We know that, legally speaking, what will happen will probably will be judged by the International Tribunal, by the Regidua mechanism, of which is in Den Haag and in Arusha. The first wish of the victims of the genocide would be that Kabuga be judged close to the people where he perpetrated the genocide. The first option, if it was the wish, would be that he be judged in Rwanda. But now we are aware that that is not likely to happen. So what the victim of justice wants is justice. So whether it's rendered in Den Haag, in Arusha, or in Kigali. Now, what we want is him to be judged, even though he's judged far from them. The most important is that he be accountable before the justice of what he have done.
What about the family members, associates on multiple continents that may have aided in his eluding capture for all of these years?
This community in France wants these people also to be persecuted and be judged for helping him for so many years and prohibiting the victims for getting justice. These people live in France. The fact of prohibiting someone for being persecuted, hiding him, when you know perfectly that the justice want to arrest him, it's an infringement to law. So that's why the community of Rwandese people living in France have lodged a lawsuit before the prosecutor of Nanterre. That's the place where Kabuga was arrested. They want all the people who are implicated in helping Kabuga escaping to justice be prosecuted and judged. So we can't let these people do what they have done without responding to justice of their facts.
Are you planning to fight to get these other people, some of which have been his family, have been in the courtroom with him in the last few hearings?
That's what we are planning to do. That's really something important for us. It has to be done. It has to send us a message to all other people who are helping other people who are wanted until now. So they have to know that this behavior should not remain unpunished. So that is something important that we are planning to do. For the moment, our main objective is to have Kabuga be prosecuted. But that fact also very important. And we will do our best so that these people also be prosecuted. So you are telling me about the one who are in court with him. Of course, we understand that in tribunal is their father who are being judged. We are not surprised that they come to help him. We are aware also that French law doesn't allow the prosecution of people who helped their parents to escape the justice. That's how French law is. But we can't believe that Kabuga have only been helped by the close family. So we believe that you have also other people who are far from the family, who are not close family, who helped him. So those ones, since the law doesn't protect them, those ones, we want them to be prosecuted and we'll do all our best so that this be the case.
Richard Gisagara is an attorney for the Rwandan Community Association in France, and he was speaking to VOA's Lori London. U.S. President Donald Trump signed an executive order Thursday he said was aimed at reining in social media platforms, although analysts doubt it will survive legal scrutiny. The president said his actions is meant to protect and uphold the free speech rights of the American people. The president decried social media companies as monopolies and have become more influential than newspapers and broadcasters. His action comes after Twitter fact-checked two of his tweets. The International Criminal Court says Ivory Coast former president Laurent Gbagbo can leave Belgium under certain conditions, following his acquittal last year over post-election violence that killed 3,000 people. Gbagbo, the first head of state to stand trial in The Hague, and his deputy were cleared in early 2019 of crimes against humanity, 8 years after the former West African leader's arrest and transferred to the court. Belgium had agreed to host Gbagbo after he was released under strict conditions, including his return to the court for a prosecution appeal against his acquittal. The World Health Organization is launching a campaign to stop the tobacco industry from marketing its deadly product to children and young people. In advance of World No Tobacco Day, which is Sunday, May 31st, the WHO warns the industry is spending much of its yearly $9 billion advertising budget on getting young people hooked on tobacco. Lisa Schlein has that story.
More than 40 million young people aged 13 to 15 smoke and use other tobacco products. The World Health Organization says the tobacco industry tries to get children and young people hooked on tobacco early in life, knowing this will turn them into lifelong smokers. Unfortunately, WHO says many smokers do not live very long. Every year, it notes millions of people have their lives cut short because of cancers, heart disease, and other smoking-related illnesses. Coordinator of WHO's No Tobacco Unit, Vinayak Prasad, says the tobacco industry invests more than $9 billion a year to advertise its products. He says much of this huge budget targets young people with attractive promotional campaigns.
At the moment, they're spending $1 million an hour, which is, by the time you finish our press conference, that's $1 million spent. And why are they doing it? Because they're doing it to find replacement users. 8 million premature deaths every year. So they need to find new replacements.
WHO says the industry sets its sights on the next generation of users by targeting children and young people in markets where tobacco products are not regulated and they can be manipulated easily. WHO is launching a new kit for school students aged 13 to 17 to protect them from the tobacco industry's exploitative practices. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United States almost sent two astronauts into orbit from American soil for the first time in nearly a decade on Thursday. Circumstances on the ground and in the skies changed flight plans for the private-public partnership between NASA and commercial flight company SpaceX. VOA's Arash Arabasadi spoke with NASA to understand what happened and what happens next.
On the brink of making history Wednesday, NASA and SpaceX pulled the plug on the first launch to orbit from U.S. soil since 2011. NASA typically flies missions into clear, sunny skies, but at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, the weather did not cooperate.
We had hope. It was bad in the morning. There was lightning, but our launch wasn't in scheduled until 4:33, I think, p.m. Eastern time. And so they were like, oh, we can clear up, we can clear up. And it did get better, and then it got worse.
Shaniqua Vereen handles public affairs out of NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, the home base of the two astronauts selected for the flight, Doug Hurley and Bob Behnken.
8.5, 9 years later to see where we are.
Hurley was aboard the last launch in 2011. Vereen says next-generation technology aboard SpaceX's Dragon is the biggest difference from that previous flight.
Most things in the Dragon, it's going to be done with a touchscreen or kind of on the hand rail, if you will, and then above them will be flat screens. And in the shuttle, of course, which is what we launched on the last time we launched from American soil, you had hundreds of buttons you had to push on, push off.
These past 9 years, American astronauts relied on Russian rockets to get to space and on board the International Space Station. Marine says a successful launch offers an additional way to get to space and does not signal the end of the U.S.-Russian partnership. Despite pleas to the public to stay home to avoid the risks of COVID-19, a crowd gathered to watch the launch, and Marine says the mission had 1.7 million viewers online. And the launch delay is expected to be short-lived. NASA and SpaceX will attempt another launch Saturday. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by visiting voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day and a fantastic weekend.